Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Well, today we're looking at the issue of the gospel and the mind and the relationship between it, recovering and shaping the intellectual life. And Bradley Green, you're an expert in this area, so thanks very much for giving us your time.
Oh, great to be here.
You teach theology at Union University in Jackson, Tennessee.
Yep.
You have a PhD from Baylor. You've written a whole series of books, and your latest one that you're currently doing is an introduction to Augustine.
That's right,
and
yes.
With your wife, you've set up a school, Augustine School, and you've got three kids yourself.
Yes, sir. Yep.
So perhaps you've had a long time in teaching and in intellectual life, lecturing. You've started a Christian school. Can you just tell us how education, and particularly Christian education, became a real calling and a passion for you?
It's a great question. Yeah, thanks, Peter. Thanks for having me. I think whenever you develop interest or decide to write a book, inevitably that's coming out of life experience, personal experience, struggles you've worked through. I had a very real conversion as a 12-year-old boy to Christ. I was raised in a more secular culture, Alaska, which has never kind of been thoroughly Christianized and lost it. Mm. It's a recent state in U.S. history, and so a very secular background. So I think really, for one thing, growing up being a Christian meant you had to wrestle with a lot of adversity in your teen years, adult years. So I think the desire to learn and think was kind of birthed out of my life experience growing up in a more secular setting.
So he's surrounded by people who are coming to life from a secular perspective. And
that's right.
Yeah.
That's
and
right.
Had to defend your faith. And
yeah, and many good friends.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, many good friends who didn't know the Lord. Some were more, you know, hostile to Christianity than others, but all that I think set a trajectory. Discovered C.S. Lewis and Francis Schaeffer as a university student, and part of it was just kind of a wonder and a joy at the Christian faith of loving the truth of the Christian faith, a fascination with how does this all work, and then coming into university and graduate school, where again the challenges are mounted against historic Christianity. So all those experiences led to wanting to work through these fundamental issues of the relationship between the Christian faith and the life of the mind.
Now, you've observed that wherever the cross is planted or the Christian faith takes root in a culture, that the academy or intellectual activity follows. So tell us about that observation.
Yeah. I think you see three institutions emerge when the gospel takes hold of the culture. You have obviously churches emerge. You have hospitals, medical clinics, the desire to heal, and schools. And so my interest, I'm interested in all those, but our discussion today is on how wherever the gospel goes, the academy follows. You can look at history, you could look at the birth of the medieval university. There's something about the Christian faith where it takes root, people begin to think and debate and argue, and they begin to write books and they begin to found schools. And I think this is all linked to what both Augustine in the 4th and 5th century and Anselm in the 1033 to 1109 talked about, and that's faith-seeking understanding. Mm. There's something about the Christian faith which both desires to understand itself, what is this thing called faith, but also wants to work through the inferences and implications and entailments of what it means to confess Jesus Christ as Lord. So kind of my thinking or argument is there's something in the Christian DNA which wants to work itself out intellectually. And so the observation is wherever the cross is planted, the academy follows. then
could you give us some specific examples of that? Perhaps, you know, historically, in different cultural contexts, where we can observe that actually happening and shaping a culture.
Yes. Yeah, I think we keep going back to Cambridge for sabbaticals and study leaves, and Cambridge has a fascinating history. You have monasteries which flow out of a desire to make sense of the written word, that flows out of a desire to translate, to retain a textual tradition. Those monasteries give birth to a second kind of school, and then those schools then give birth to universities. And so I think the classic example would be the medieval university, which is a flowering of an attempt to give attention to words, to understand reality, to understand God. And of course, one of the great ironies of Western history and culture as you move into modernity and so-called postmodernity is, you know, kind of biting the hand that feeds you. You've got this birth of the intellectual life and development of the intellectual life in the medieval world and what follows after that, flowing from certain key Christian convictions, I would argue. And then I think what you see now is kind of biting the hand that feeds you.
Any later historical examples? The United States.
Sure, yeah. Sure.
How do you observe that in American history?
Sure, sure. So you have in the United States, sorry, we left. Yeah, but
we were okay with that.
Okay. you know, you have all these schools founded, many of them, the Princetons, the Yales, and the Harvards, founded really for training of preachers. And then out of that training of preachers, if you're going to train preachers, you have to make sense of literature and philosophy and history and et cetera. And so virtually all of our first round of universities and educational institutions had some sort of Christian impetus to start them that was at the heart of their founding. Whether they can retain that as the Christian faith gets lost is a good question.
I was struck by this recently on a trip to South Korea, perhaps a little bit more contemporary, but Korean culture was more or less constant for hundreds of years through various dynasties, and then missionaries came in the mid-19th century, established churches, there was major revival in the early 20th century, and then just what you described, the universities, the hospitals, and the schools, and the huge development we've seen in South Korea around the time of the partition and then into the modern days with this explosion of cultural activity, really all came back to that, and yet nothing had happened for hundreds of years before that. So we're still seeing it, I guess, aren't we? Now, why do you think this is? Why is there this seemingly inextricable link between the cross being planted and culture being transformed in these ways?
It's a great question. I think you have a number of things. I think you have a doctrine of creation that's at the heart of the Christian faith. So when you look at other worldviews and ways of understanding reality, the world may or may not be real. It may or may not be good. It may or may not be ordered. When I teach the Greek and Roman myths at Augustine School, I'm always amazed at the capricious nature of the gods, the instability of their emotions.
Yeah.
But in the Christian faith, you have a good God who's created a good world. He loves the world. There's a certain constancy to the world. I can pretty much trust that the world, the way it is today, will be a lot like the way it was, you know, yesterday and the way it will be tomorrow. There's a certain good providence and governance ordering the world. And so the world, in a sense, begs to be discovered. The way God has structured us in the world, there's good reason to attend to the world and to take joy in the world and to try to understand it. Another key point is at the heart of the Christian faith is a certain attention to history. You have a first century event, the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, which in a sense governs in an interesting way all that comes before, because history is
looking. So everything leads up and
yes,
to that.
Yeah. Leads, yes, yeah. Leads to those first century events. But also the rest of history is shaped by the outworking of the reality of the gospel. So the Christian has inherently an intention to attend to the past. So there's a healthy backward-looking sense of Christianity in that a first century event 2,000 years ago is still, in a sense, the center of reality. So the Christian faith has an impetus to look backward. There's an impetus to attend to what has come before. The Old Testament ends in the book of Malachi with, let's say, 1,400 years since the law. And so there is, what does the Lord say to Malachi? Remember the law. So you have 1,400 years later, a command, look to the past. And I think you have, therefore, in the Christian faith, so the gospel is planted somewhere, as those teachings take root, people begin to realize, okay, the past matters, the past is real, the past in a sense is never the past, the past is always influencing the future. And so for those kind of reasons, I think when the Christian faith takes root, people begin to explore and understand and try to make sense of the world.
Mm-hmm. Now, in terms of epistemology, we talk about different theories of knowledge or epistemologies, and you've talked about a biblical theory of knowledge.
Yeah.
What would be the basic building blocks for that, and how would that differ from other approaches?
That's a great question. I would take a fairly traditional reformational understanding of thinking in terms of creation and fall and redemption and consummation. And so if we were to work through a biblical theology of knowledge, so we're created beings, so our ability to know is always, in a sense, derivative. We don't create ourselves. We're not autonomous. We always know because we are created beings. God's holding us together, including our intellectual knowing, epistemic abilities. And there's a certain kind of potential for ability to know that's pre-fall. But when you think about it, in Genesis 3, it's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil that's bound up with the fall. If you look at Genesis 3, I think you could argue that the first couple deciding to make sense of the world on their own terms instead of God's terms, so kind of an epistemic knowing error, is at the root of the fall. I think you can work through all what's often called the noetic effects of the fall, that sin affects our noetic or knowing abilities. Fools hate knowledge. Romans 1, that's Proverbs. Romans 1, we suppress the knowledge of God. So the biblical picture, I think, is that our knowing abilities are affected by the fall. It's striking when you look at conversion, 2 Corinthians 4, 1 Peter 1, 3. Somehow knowledge is key to conversion. We actually come to know something of God, and that leads to or is a part of conversion. Our knowledge is renewed over time. Romans 12, 1 and 2, we're to be transformed by the renewing of our mind. Even our ultimate destiny, 1 Corinthians 13, 12, is to know God, to see God face to face, and to know as we have been fully known. So I think the whole, you could write a biblical theology of knowledge, taking into account pre-fall knowing, knowledge at the fall, how sin affects our knowing now, how we're knowledge is bound up with redemption and conversion, how we're renewed through time, and how our ultimate destiny is to see the Lord and to know him more fully.
Mm-hmm. That's very helpful. Now, you've touched a little bit on history already and explained that Christian history is very much linear, beginning,
yes,
a middle,
yes,
and an end, looking,
yes,
back, looking forward. Can you unpack that a bit more for us?
Sure.
And talk a bit about the particular significance of history for Christians?
That's great. Yeah, I've been helped, besides the scriptures and besides trying to work through what the scriptures teach, I've been helped by an American thinker named Richard Weaver, who's a 20th century, he's actually a rhetorician, something of a political theorist, and But what Weaver likes to talk about is that part of what it means to be human is to know where you've come from. Part of what it means to be human and most fully human is to have a whole set of memories and have a past, and that past shapes you. And the more you cut people off from the past, I think it's one mark of modernity to be to dismiss the past mm-hmm. as important. The more we dismiss the past, the more I think you could say modernity has tended to make us less human. We're disconnected from what's come before. We're disconnected from the past. And so there's this kind of anti-human tendency, I would argue, in modernity. Richard Weaver could talk about a suicidal impulse in modernity. The older, well, now deceased thinker Malcolm Muggeridge could ask, does modern man have a certain death wish in the way that modern man wants to cut himself off from what's come before? But I think when you look at the Christian faith, when you look at the fact that a certain first century event, the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus, is shaping, it is what history is pointing to, it is what you and I now look back as marking all of history, and you realize that history is going somewhere, that changes the whole game. So when Augustine was writing, and early pre-modern Christians are writing, they're looking at the present, our present life, our present thinking, our present endeavors. They matter, but they're always shaped and formed by the recognition that there's a certain goal to history. The city of God will one day be fully established. It'll be fully realized. And that's that telos, or that end, or goal, is what kind of helps us make sense of life in the present. I think one of the marks of modernity is the loss of that telos, or the loss of that goal. So we live life, we walk through life, but someone who's not a Christian, and I'm generalizing here, what's fallen out of the culture is any sense of that history's going somewhere. There's a meaning and there's a purpose to history. And what the Christian comes along and says is there's a great and grand goal to history. God is at work. God is moving history towards a goal. Once that falls out, I think that helps explain something of the despair of our current cultural moment.
And secularists, some of them will think a lot about the future, perhaps even be obsessively preoccupied with it. But as Christians, we're looking beyond, aren't we, to what we call the last things, to death, judgment, heaven, hell, the return of Christ. So what's the particular significance of the future for living in the present and specifically for intellectual activity in the present?
It's a great question. And you could approach it a lot of ways. I think a lot of the flippancy, sarcasm that we find in our non-Christian friends has something to do with a lack of a sense that we are living in this life against the backdrop of a future judgment. I know it's not always popular to talk about that, but it's part and parcel of the gospel message. It's part and parcel of the overall scriptural message that there is a last assize. There is a last account. Now, the good news, the gospel helps us think about how we can stand before God, because we're in Christ by faith alone. So there's a beautiful Christian message which helps us have assurance, even though we know a judgment's coming. But nonetheless, we live our lives in the present knowing we will give an account. We are accountable for our actions. But in addition to that, if you take 1 Corinthians 13:12 seriously, that one day we'll see God face to face, and we will know fully as we have been fully known, that kind of changes the whole deal. That means when I'm studying or reading or teaching my students, when I'm working on my Greek grammar or trying to go back and get French or whatever I'm doing, I'm reading and thinking, I think you can make the case that in the Christian understanding of education, the intellectual life of why study, is that what you are doing in the present, in a mysterious way, you are preparing yourself to one day see God face to face. All of our educational efforts in the present have a way of shaping us and preparing us to one day see God face to face. Because God, in the Christian conception, is a Trinity. He's personal. It's not just a force like Star Wars, or just not an impersonal mist, but he's a tripersonal being who can be known. So I think you can make the case that in the best of Christian thinking about the life of the mind and education, the intellectual life, is our current efforts now are in a sense preparatory for our ultimate mental life or ultimate intellectual life, and that is seeing God and knowing him more fully.
My own background's in medicine, and one of the famous Christian doctors of the past was Thomas Sydenham, who was a Puritan living in the 17th century at the time of the Commonwealth in Britain and the Great Plague and the Fire of London and all of those amazing events. And he used to say to his medical students that human beings were incredibly important for two reasons. Firstly, because they were made in the image of God and therefore very precious. Mm. And secondly, because God himself became a human being in the person of Christ and so gave nobility to the human race. And
right.
He also said that when doctors are treating their patients, they should be aware not only that they are also people who are going to get diseases and die one day, but that one day they will stand before the judge of the whole universe and give account for the lives of patients entrusted into their care. So that it's the same thing that you're talking about of the end point of history. Now, can you tell us a bit more about the link between these great events prophesied and acted out in history of the death and resurrection and ascension of Christ, and then what you've already been touching upon, this 1 Corinthians 13:12 idea of seeing him face to face?
Yes, it's a great question. I think as I've tried to think through this and work through this, and that's the title of the book and the talks is The Gospel in the Mind, is you got to, I can flesh it out a little bit, is when you get texts like Ephesians 5, where it talks about Christ, or husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, but there's not a period there, and gave himself up for her to sanctify her and make her holy so that the bride, the church, might be presented back to Christ holy without blemish. So I think if you really are trying to work through why did Jesus die, he died, yes, to bring us from death to life. And if that was the end of the story, it'd be a great story. And I don't want to in any way minimize the importance of conversion, moving from death to life, that is central to the Christian message, to the gospel message. But if you follow Paul's logic, Jesus is not dying simply to get us from death to life. He's dying in order that the church might become holy and be presented back to Christ at the last day. So what I've done in this book and other things I've tried to work through is argue that, and John Owen does this, Gerhardus Voss does this, Jonathan Edwards does this, Calvin does this, is that when Jesus dies, yes, I move from death to life, but also the rest of my transformation, in a sense, is still flowing from the death, burial, and resurrection of Jesus. And so I like to think of the intellectual life as kind of a subset or an aspect of sanctification. So do I get in justified by faith and then spend the rest of my life, sanctification, working on some different principle? Or is it the case that I enter into this relationship with the Lord by faith apart from work, and then I am sanctified by that same gospel power changing me over time. Mm. So my argument is that one day I'm going to see God face to face. How does that come about? I think that comes about because the Lord has mercy on me, I come to faith, I'm converted, and then that same gospel power which led to my conversion is also that same gospel power is the gospel power which is transforming me and allowing me to think more and more the way I ought to think. So think of Ephesians 5. Jesus purchases me, he dies for me, and that same power is cleansing me. And I just want to say, my growth in Christ flows from the blood of Christ. My growth in Christ includes thinking God's thoughts more and more after him and having a mind renewed, not by some non-gospel principle, but flowing from the gospel itself. Mm. So my argument is simply really that my transformation includes the transformation of the mind, and that that transformation really flows from the blood of Christ being applied to me throughout my whole life.
Mm. And so worked out in loving God with all one's heart, one's mind,
yes,
one's soul,
yes,
and one's strength.
Yes.
Now, you just changing tack a little bit,
yep,
you've argued very much that the Christian faith has a strong theology of language. How does the Christian faith produce a strong theology of language and establish that words and language,
yes,
really do matter?
Yeah, that's a great question. It's I think this is one of the most precious insights that the Christian faith provides, particularly in a culture which can be rather skeptical about language. Is there's a very beautiful theology of language in the scriptures themselves and in the Christian tradition. So as you know, you have God speaks the world into being. He creates the world in and through his Son, who is the Word. We have the second person, the Trinity, who is in the beginning was the Word. And so you have the second person of the Godhead himself can be described as the Logos, or is the Logos, the Word. And so we know from the, just a quick overview of the Bible, God creates through his Word, he redeems through his Word, he sustains through his Word. We, Ephesians 4, give grace to each other through our words. Ephesians 4, 29 and following, we're told to speak a certain way in order to give grace to those around us. We are called to pray in words. We are called to preach, evangelize, speak the gospel in words. I'm to encourage and rebuke in words. I'm to worship in words. And at the very end of history, look at Revelation 5:9. I and people from every tribe and tongue will be worshiping the Lord of God, presumably singing with words. So Christianity is inherently a wordish religion, which again I think is why when the gospel is planted, people start to write books and think and argue and debate, and etc.
Now you're implying here very much that knowledge or intellectual pursuit has a moral component as well, because we can say good things or bad things. We can say things in helpful ways or in ungodly ways. So what is the moral component of knowledge or intellectual
pursuit? Question.
It's
a great question. I think one of the unique things about the Christian faith when it's thinking about knowledge is this is, there's a God, he's created the world, he sustained the world, and we always know on his terms. And so when I look at the world, according to Romans 1, I can either look at the world and because of what I know, I can honor God or I can suppress the knowledge of God. Mm-hmm. So in that very act of knowing, it's not a morally neutral thing, but I am actually, my will is bound up with my intellect, if you want to separate those in some thorough way, but my will is bound up with my knowing, and that apart from the gospel, I suppress what I actually know. Mm-hmm. So that suppression of the knowledge of God is not a happenstance thing. It's a moral thing. And I think we have, as creatures, a moral obligation to make sense of all the world, every fact, in light of who God is and what he's spoken. And when we suppress the knowledge of God, and we don't make sense of the world on his terms, we're engaging in a kind of moral rebellion. So it's moral, theological, all the way down, as I see it, including our knowing activities.
And how's that observation of the link between knowing and between knowing God and morality,
mm-hmm.
how has that helped you personally, as a teacher, as a lecturer, to worship God better in what you're
That's
doing?
Great. Mm. That's great. I when you first started to ask the question, the first thing that came to mind is when I'm teaching students, I am not simply, well, I'm not a Nietzschean, so Friedrich Nietzsche, I'm not believing in simply the will to power, or I'm trying to manipulate students or the like. But neither am I, what we call philosophy an encyclopedist. I'm not simply downloading neutral data so my students can go out and download neutral data to the next generation. What am I doing when I teach? When you're teaching, you are shaping and forming persons, and you're actually trying to help them make sense of all reality in light of who God is and what he's spoken. So there's this moral component to the craft, I think, of teaching, where you're not just a dispenser of information, but you really are trying to form and shape persons who likewise will think God's thoughts after them.
And how's that shaped your own practice as an educator?
Yeah. I think it's
specifically. Can you give us some
examples? Sure. So I think when I'm sitting in my office studying, or when I'm teaching, when I'm researching, it is now I believe in real sinfulness, so my motives are always mixed, as all of our motives are mixed. So I'm not squeaky clean on this, but the goal is to see my life as getting some writing done, some teaching, starting a school and trying to move it along, is all those tasks are moral tasks in that I have a calling. I've been called to teach. I've helped start a school. I've tried to write some. Is those aren't just to get tenure. Those aren't just to have an increase in salary or whatever. But again, my life is lived against a telos of a last assize, a judgment, and I am called to be a certain kind of person in submission to the lordship of Christ. So my teaching, Lord willing, my writing, school leadership, etc., those are all discipleship, vocational subset of sanctification activities, which ultimately should be offered to the Lord. Mm. It's not just, I do want to feed my family. Mm. It's not just that. It is something, hopefully, all those aspects of my vocation are something being offered to the Lord.
Bradley, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you, Peter.
Really illuminating.
Thank you, sir.